Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation. Second Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis. Session number one, Clinical Aspects.
Good morning. My name is Paul Peach. I'm the medical director here at Roosevelt Institute. I want to welcome all of you today to the second annual symposium on post-polio effects. Although Frank Rizicki, the director, was scheduled to see you this morning, he has been unavoidably detained on some other matters, but he will be seeing you this evening at the cocktail party. And I'd like to welcome each of you to Warm Springs, and then to the Roosevelt Institute. And I'm sure I understand that there were some delays because of the weather last evening. And I apologize for those, but there's not too much we can do about that. We do anticipate that your stay here is going to be both pleasant and productive. And if you have any questions or need any directions, our staff members will be available to give you assistance. And if you recall the hospitality, the table where you all signed up this morning, just before you had breakfast, there will be someone at that area to give you assistance or answer any of your questions at all during the day. We think that the Roosevelt Institute is certainly a fitting location for a symposium on the late effects of poliomyelitis. And we certainly anticipate that this symposium is going to be as successful and productive as the first symposium we hosted 2 years ago. The Roosevelt Institute has served as a center for care of post-polio effects for over 58 years and has continued to do so to the present. And at the present time, we are maintaining an active clinic for the treatment of post-polio effects. And Dr. Catherine Hoffman directs and manages this clinic for us. And you'll be hearing from Dr. Hoffman later today. And we are very grateful for Dr. Hoffman. Her residency training included training here at the Institute under the direction of the late Dr. Bennett. Before I turn the program over to Dr. Halstead, I would like to note there are a couple of minor changes in your schedule today. At noon today, everyone will be having lunch at the Victorian Tea Room in Warm Springs, and buses will be taking you to Warm Springs. But you'll have an option of either taking a tour of the Little White House or the Roosevelt Institute on the grounds here, or you'll have the option of staying in the village and shopping around at your leisure. For those of you who are planning on touring either the Little White House or the Roosevelt Institute, the bus will be leaving here at 11:30.
Thank you, Paul.
And many thanks to the members of the Warm Springs staff who have helped make this conference possible. And a hearty welcome to all of you, also a dry welcome. I hope that we do see some sunshine in the next few days. I understand the summer has been very dry, and we're now getting a compensatory period of wet weather. I'd like to ask that we take a minute to get to know each other very briefly. It is true I've probably talked to just about every one of you, but I do not know or can't put a name with a face in each case. So if we can just take a moment to go around, and if you would give your name and where you're from in a loud enough voice that all of us can hear. I'll begin. I'm Laura Halstead, and currently from the National Rehabilitation Hospital in Washington, D.C. And why don't we start in the far back? Oh, we have a roving mic, and that might help. Bill Ray, goodness. The other thing while we're getting the mic is that I would just urge that each of you wear your name tag at least for this day so that we can all get to know one another on a first name basis.
My name is Jörgen Borg. I'm from Stockholm.
Lennart Grimbuk, Karolinska Hospital, Stockholm.
Christian Borg, Stockholm. Arthur Salisbury and Marcia Dimes of Birth Defects Foundation in White Plains, in New York.
Birgit Opum, Copenhagen, Denmark.
Angelo Sormas, Houston. Dave Buchholz, I'm from Johns Hopkins.
Reuben Feldman, University of Alberta in Edmonton.
Donald Mulder, Rochester, Minnesota.
Laura Smith, Houston, Texas.
Sybil Cole, private practice, Houston, Texas.
Augusta Alba, New York.
Jenny Lai, Gazette International Networking Institute, St. Louis.
Judith Raymond, Gazette International in St. Louis.
Herman Fisher, Rancho Los Amigos Hospital in Downey, California.
Bruce Pachter, New York.
Hussein Pazishpur from Washington, D.C.
John Bach from New Jersey.
Axel Fugelmeyer, University of Umeå, Arctic Circle, Sweden.
Jacqueline Perry, Rancho Las Vegas Hospital in California.
Alan Berger, Albert Einstein, New York.
Fred Maynard, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor.
Ted Munsat, Tufts University, Boston.
Dave Weekers, Columbus, Ohio.
Anna McComas, McMaster University, Canada.
Porter Bradley, Burlington, Vermont, and I live exactly opposite North Pole, New York.
Dick Sprott, the National Institute on Aging in Bethesda.
Don Sanders, Duke University Medical Center, Durham, North Carolina.
Burke Jubal, Northwestern University, Chicago.
Masa Jawid, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Mitchell Zoller, Medical World News.
Marvin Brook, University of Washington, Seattle.
Marius Delacas, NIH.
I'm Jack Antel from the Montreal Neurologic Institute, and I live north of Dr. Bradley's North Pole.
Robin Bielik from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta.
Jonathan Brostoff, Middlesex Hospital, London.
Peter Gow, Auckland, New Zealand.
Mary Card, Rochester, Minnesota, and Ireland.
Tony Windebank, Rochester, Minnesota, where it only feels like the North Pole.
Jim Agri, University of Wisconsin, Madison.
Gunnar Grimby, University of Göteborg, Sweden.
Gisle Enersson, Göteborg, Sweden, and currently living in Reykjavik, Iceland.
Ernie Johnson from Ohio State University, Columbus.
Ohio. Janine Spears, Sister Kenny, Minneapolis.
Well, a warm welcome. We are some 55 participants from 7 countries. And it's a minor miracle that we all made it safe and sound. There are several people who were not able to make it at the last moment. Dr. Neil Cashman, who did, in fact, I guess, make it to the grounds last night and then had a last-minute phone call that his wife was going into labor, and he is back on the plane to be at his baby and mother. Well, we have an update in Montreal, Canada. Dr. Herbison had to withdraw at the last moment. Dr. Larson was hospitalized at the last moment from Hellerup, Denmark. Dr. Paffenbarger had to withdraw at the last minute, as did Dr. Shahani, as did Dr. Thomas and Dr. Turga. I would like to mention that the proceedings are going to be taped by an outfit called Infomedics. They're a group that taped the proceedings last time. They're a professional taping organization that tapes symposia. They may have sent to you a permission slip. Mine was had the return address to my old address, so if yours also was sent to Houston, Texas, I never got it. So what I need to do now is simply alert you that the proceedings are being taped, not only the presentations, but the questions and answer, and would like to know if there is anybody who objects to having their comments, their discussion, or paper taped. The purpose of the taping is simply to allow us, after the proceedings, to clarify what was said, and if we have the stamina and the wherewithal to try to put together a discussion section to the proceedings. Do I hear anybody that would not want to have themselves taped? I'll accept that then as approval for taping. Finally, just another housekeeping item. Again, in an attempt to make the most of the discussion sessions, we're using a roving mic system that'll be manned by Dr. Weekers. And the idea is that if you have a question, please raise your hand, catch his attention, and then you will have the floor and have the mic. By speaking clearly into the mic and identifying yourself, it serves two purposes. One, for the purpose of the taping, we know who has spoken those lovely words, and also we all can hear them. So we're going to give that a try, and if that shouldn't work, we might try a standing mic. At this time, I would like to begin the program by asking Dr. Weekers to come forward. Dr. Weekers is well known in this field, is affiliated with Ohio State University, and is in private practice in Central Ohio, and is going to give a presentation on historical overview. David.
Like most things in medicine and others areas, we're not the first to trod these paths, and I thought it might be of interest just in starting this morning to review some of the historical aspects of the concept of post-polio. Actually, the initial concept of a previous disease of the spine making the spine or the patient susceptible to another disorder was put forth, to the best of our knowledge, by Charcot in 1875. It was at this time that a colleague of his, Dr. Raymond, presented a case before the Society of Biology in Paris of a 19-year-old tanner who had had polio at 6 months of age, leaving the left arm and leg affected. He had a almost acceptable recovery by the age of 7, but continued to have weakness and partial hemiparesis on the left side. His work as a tanner involved a lot of aggressive, hard labor, especially involving the right arm. And then subsequently, at age 18, he became progressively weaker in the right arm, followed later by weakness of the right leg. Charcot interpreted this case as being infantile paralysis at 6 months of age, and then subsequently having the lesion, because of aggressive work, extend from the left side of the cord to the right. Surprisingly, in 1875, there was also a paper by Cornell and Lapine of a 27-year-old male who had polio in infancy, affecting both lower extremities, and then had a complete recovery. During the Franco-Prussian War, which we all remember, he was overexerted with long marching and other activities, and then 8 months later developed progressive weakness of the left lower extremity, and subsequently developed a bilateral arm weakness over a period of several years. Carrier, in 1875, also presented two cases, one of an 18-year-old courier who again had polio at a very early age, 6 months, and then at the age of 16, developed problems on the right side in the shoulder and hand. A second case of a 16-year-old, again with polio at 6 months, resulting in paraplegia 15 years later then, had increased weakness in the legs and arms as well. There was very little in the literature until a colleague of Charcot, Volpien, who was actually more of a pathologist than anything, described a case of a 3.5-year-old girl who had polio at that age with paralysis of both lower extremities, and then subsequently 15 years of age, developed increased weakness in the legs, subsequently into the arms, and then progressive atrophy. Now, he performed an autopsy on this case, and this is probably the first reported autopsy in a patient with a secondary problem of weakness following polio, and found periependymal myelitis with loss of anterior horn cells and focal areas of degeneration throughout the anterior horn. In 79, there were actually about 8 cases reported. Most were in French. Selig Mueller actually recorded the first cases in the German literature. He provided four cases in 1879. Basically, these were young people who had had polio during the first several years of life, who then later developed weakness in either the same extremity in two cases or the opposite extremity in two of the other cases. Now, throughout the remainder of the 19th century, about every year, there was one or two cases that would be presented, mainly in the French and in the German literature. Then in 1899, the first cases actually appeared in the English language by Sir William Gower's writing in his textbook of neurology, the third edition, which was published in 1899, where he presented two cases in his book of lateral sclerosis that had developed in people who had previously had polio. Hirsch was probably the first one to publish in the American literature and presented this case before the New York Neurological Society of a 45-year-old tailor who had polio at age 2 and his left arm continued to have weakness. 40 years later, at the age of 42, started to develop stiffness and weakness in both lower extremities and then progressed to the point where he could not walk. He also developed spasticity, atrophy of the trunk and arm muscles sometimes later. He was diagnosed as ALS, and an extensive autopsy with pathological slides from the cord showed a myelitis. And Hirsch presented the theory that a lot of these cases of at that point in time, which were felt to be systemic involvement of the anterior horn cells, were actually more of a myelitis-type picture. By the end of the 19th century, three basic theories had been established to describe this condition. The first theory was that there was irritation by the old lesion, which enfeebled the cord, making it susceptible to further disease. The second theory was basically put forth by Charcot, that certain individuals seemed to have a predisposition to obtaining or developing polio at some time in their life, or progressive muscular atrophy at another time. The third theory was that the inflammatory process resulted in some type of scarring, which formed a latent but permanent focus, which could flare up at a later date. They were using tuberculosis here as the model for this third theory, which was quite prevalent at that time. Well, as the 20th century rolled around, Dr. Charles Potts at the University of Pennsylvania was the first person to actually look at a substantial review of the literature, and he reviewed the literature back to Charcot's original involvement and the original cases of 1875 and found 36 cases. In reviewing the literature, he felt that 28 of these cases could probably be diagnosed as progressive muscular atrophy. Two of them could be diagnosed as ALS, two as a myelitis, and four as another attack of polio. At this time, it was still uncertain what was the source of polio or the cause of polio or the fact that you could get it more than one time. Now, following Potts, there continued to be individual cases that appeared in the literature. And then in 1936, Simon and Riley again performed an extensive review published in the American literature. And they found over 66 cases which they felt could be diagnosed as progressive muscular atrophy. They felt that this was really the major secondary disorder following polio that had been reported in the literature. They also reported a case of their own. They felt that the incidental finding of only six individuals with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis really downplayed the relationship between polio and ALS. And they tried to basically rule this out as simply being a coincidence. Now, the English presented the work of long-term follow-up following anterior horn cell disorders, and Zilke reviewed the cases from Queen Square and published this in 1962. They had a whole series of individual people who had anterior horn cell type disorders, and they were looking at the longevity of these individuals with ALS, progressive muscular atrophy, and the other types of anterior horn cell disorders. But he became quite interested in the fact that they had 11 cases of people who presented to the Queen Square who had had a previous episode of polio. And 5 out of these 11 cases did have extensor plantar responses. 10 of the cases showed slowly progressive muscular atrophy, and one case had a fairly rapid progression with exaggerated reflexes. His review was really the first look at the long-term effects of the anterior horn cell type disorder that occurred later following polio. Up until this time, there had really been no long-term follow-up study. He had followed these people, many of them, for 11 to 15 years. This paper, again, appeared in the French literature, where Pinelli and Romelli reviewed the literature, had 5 or 6 cases of their own, and they formulated 5 hypotheses that they felt at that point in time in 64 were probably the theories of most acceptable nature, so to speak. The first was that the late progression of muscular atrophy following an acute attack of polio many years previous was purely coincidental. They felt that, like Charcot's initial concept that polio may produce a predisposition to progressive muscular atrophy, the third hypothesis that there was an endogenous predisposition to the spine to certain diseases, such as polio or ALS or progressive muscular atrophy. The fourth theory, that there was a discrepancy between demands and the functional capacity of the motor neuron. And this was basically due to the fact that the motor unit territory had increased dramatically with reinnervation. And that finally, that progressive muscular atrophy was due to a reactivation of the viral infection. Campbell, Williams, and Pierce then presented 5 cases in 1969, one of which had extensor plantar responses. They, again, like Zilka, stressed the benign nature of progressive muscular atrophy following polio, and they felt that one of their cases was actually due to compromise of the nerve root rather than an anterior horn cell disorder, and brought up the whole concept of maybe this is not strictly a motor neuron problem, but possibly it's at a root level, and certainly people with severe scoliosis could be having root compromise. Well, we all know this paper very well. In 1972, the work from the Mayo Clinic with Dr. Mulder, and the 34 cases that they reviewed at that time. 6 of those did have extensor plantar responses, or at least 4 definite and 2 were questionable. They stressed the gradual onset of weakness and basically brought to our minds again this concept of late progressive weakness following polio. So the 20th century up until the mid-70s had demonstrated again that there was some type of a relationship between polio and a late onset of progressive muscular weakness. Dr. Hubble and myself, performing single fiber techniques, demonstrated that there was some difficulty in neuromuscular transmission in some of these large reinnervated motor units 30 to 40 years post-polio, when recording from normal people who were really not complaining of problems using muscles that had recovered to either grade G or 4/5 MRC grades strength or normal strength. And we felt that there might be some peripheral disintegration of the reinnervated motor units with time. Dr. DeLacus reported this year then of 27 patients that they had followed for 4.5 to 20 years, during which time none developed ALS. They all got progressively weaker at a very slow pace. The muscle biopsies revealing isolated atrophic annular fibers that, from a histological point of view, indicated that they were newly deinnervated. No group atrophy was seen. Single fiber demonstrating, again, transmission abnormalities and some concern about oligoclonal bands, and the possible effects of immunology or reactivation of the virus, which remains to be determined. So it does appear that we are dealing with a nerve terminal disorder that is slowly deteriorating, affecting the terminal axon and a dropping off of individual muscle fibers. Two terms have become quite common now, and I think we probably should, for the sake of terminology through the rest of the meeting, review these just for a moment. Post-polio syndrome, by general usage over the past several years, has been used to describe the whole complex of the late effects of polio, whether these are direct or indirect. By direct, meaning progressive weakness. By indirect, meaning people that have deterioration of joints early in life due to a mechanical disadvantage of that joint wearing out early in life. People that have to deal also with the psychosocial problems of old disability now becoming progressive again, as well as pulmonary compromise. So the term post-polio syndrome we're using to describe the overall problems of the late effects of polio. The term progressive post-polio muscular atrophy, or PPMA, by general usage at this point in time, has basically come to be a part of the post-polio syndrome and used to describe those individuals where there is definite and well-documented, proven progressive muscular weakness with time that occurs some period of time following the acute episode of polio, usually approximately 10 years or longer. So these terms, post-polio syndrome, which is the overall term for the problem dealing with the late effects of polio, and progressive post-polio muscular atrophy, which is a part of the post-polio syndrome, focusing mainly on progressive muscular weakness, will be the terms that we will try to use in our discussions during the program this weekend. And here we were 2 years ago. Much has taken place in the past several years. Much work has been done. Many questions remain. Many new questions will be brought up today. Some of the questions that we need to be thinking about or want to consider at the meeting, if the motor neuron is the site of the problem, if it is not able to keep pace with the metabolic demands of all its reinnervated muscle fibers and is losing them a few at a time, what is the cause for this? Why is this happening? Are these motor neurons or cell bodies carrying scars from the previous polio, which is now limiting their functional activity with time? Have these motor neurons, which have been hyperfunctioning or overworking themselves, are they aging much faster and they just simply can't keep up all the metabolic demands? What is the relationship of viral or immunological mechanisms and how is it affecting the motor neuron and altering its function? The other question is, what really is happening to this motor neuron? Is it simply dropping off all of the fibers that it's reinnervated and dropping back to its original size? Are the fibers that we're losing from the motor neuron the ones that were reinnervated last, the ones that were reinnervated first? Does the motor neuron actually die off altogether, or does it simply go back to its original normal size? What is the role of overexertion or sudden vigorous exercises that precipitate sudden weakness in these individuals? Are we dealing with the death of a few large reinnervated motor units simply due to overwork? Is this sudden onset of weakness that occurs sometimes with overexertion due to the death of a few anterior horn cells? Or is it just a fatiguing phenomenon that's occurring at the transmission of many muscle fibers that the motor neuron is never able to really regain? Is there actually some physical breakage occurring in vigorously contracting muscle that contains a lot of scar and fibrous tissue that may actually be physically breaking the terminal axon sprouts? Exercise, what role does it play? Will it strengthen the muscle that is getting progressively weaker? Or will it result simply in a more rapid demise of the already overworked motor neuron and its terminal axons? These are a few of the questions that hopefully will stimulate some thought at this meeting. And I turn the program back to Dr. Halstead. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. Halstead, whom I think everyone knows, now at the National Rehab Hospital in Washington, who will speak on a consecutive follow-up of a large number of post-polio patients.
This paper summarizes the clinical experience of all patients with a confirmed history of polio who were examined and treated at a post-polio clinic over a period of 1 year. The data based on this experience expand and refine our understanding of the late effects of polio obtained from two questionnaire studies carried out in 1983 and 1984. An outpatient clinic devoted to the special problems of persons with a history of paralytic polio was established at the Institute for Rehabilitation and Research in Houston, Texas, in the spring of 1984. Patients were seen by members of an interdisciplinary team and underwent a standard comprehensive evaluation with emphasis on three objectives: confirming the diagnosis of paralytic polio, excluding other medical and neurological conditions that might explain the patient's present new health problems, and three, initiating effective therapeutic interventions. The diagnosis of post-polio syndrome was based on five criteria and was essentially a diagnosis by exclusion. The criteria are: 1, a confirmed history of paralytic polio; 2, partial to fairly complete neurological and functional recovery; 3, a period of stability of at least 15 years duration; 4, the onset of two or more of the following health problems since achieving a period of stability: unaccustomed fatigue, muscle and or joint pain, new weakness in muscles previously affected and or unaffected, functional loss, cold intolerance, and new atrophy; and 5, no other medical diagnosis to explain these health problems. From July 1, 1984 to June 30, 1985, a total of 174 persons were evaluated in the clinic. A breakdown of the status of these patients is outlined in the first slide. Five patients did not fulfill the criteria for diagnosis of paralytic polio, and those with confirmed polio, 37 were either worried well, did not meet the criteria for post-polio syndrome as just outlined, or had a coexisting diagnosis which accounted for their new health problems. This leaves, at the bottom of the slide, 132 patients with new health problems, probably related to their polio, and with a presumptive diagnosis of post-polio syndrome. The next slide lists a frequency analysis of the non-polio medical conditions that were diagnosed to be the principal or only explanation of the patient's new health problems. Of these, respiratory disease was by far the most common. The next slide summarizes selected characteristics of the group of 132 persons with a presumptive diagnosis of post-polio syndrome. Two-thirds are women. The median age is 45 years, with a range from 24 to 86, not 85 as noted there, and the median duration of polio of 38 years. The characteristics of this group at onset are shown on the next slide. The median age was 7, 82% were hospitalized at onset, almost half had involvement of all four limbs, and 16% required the use of a ventilator. So, in general, this was a group with fairly severe polio. This next slide provides an overview of the natural history of polio for the clinic group. The median time of onset, 7 years, points A to B. Median time to achieve full recovery, 8 years, points B to C. The period of neurological and functional stability, a median of 25 years, points C to D. Followed by the onset of new health problems, that had existed a median of 5 years, before being seen in the clinic, points D to E. The dotted line represents the projected clinical course of polios not seen in the clinic and who are presumably not experiencing new health problems related to their earlier disease. The most common new health and ADL problems, ADL's activity of daily living, are listed in rank order in this slide and are similar to numbers already in the literature. Unaccustomed fatigue, 89%, muscle and joint pain, 71%, and so on. By contrast, the percent of people experiencing cold intolerance, 29%, and atrophy, 28%, were considerably less. Among all 132 patients examined, none was experiencing new atrophy by itself. That is, nobody complained of atrophy as their only new health problem. And no patients had upgoing toes or long track signs. This next slide shows a frequency distribution for the six most common experienced new health problems, with the number of problems in the first column, the number of persons with each number of problems listed in the second column, and then a listing of each new problem. F being fatigue, P pain, W weakness, and so on. In the first row, you can see among the 11 persons who had only two problems, the most common complaints were pain, fatigue, and weakness. The same pattern was seen in many of the other patients, with the most common cluster consisting of fatigue, pain, weakness, and functional loss. Cold intolerance and atrophy, to your far right, were experienced most commonly along with a set of four or five other problems. Slide off, please. At this point, I would like to say a word or two about terminology. We have used the term post-polio syndrome intentionally in preference to other terms such as post-polio sequelae or the late effects of polio for two reasons. One, it is gaining wider acceptance and usage among both medical and lay communities. And two, it is developing sufficient specificity to be clinically useful. In this group of patients, new atrophy was relatively uncommon, 27%. So the term progressive post-polio muscular atrophy, or PPMA, clearly is not appropriate for the majority of these patients. On the contrary, post-polio syndrome appears to be a more general classification under which PPMA is an important subtype. The hypothesis that PPMA is in fact a subtype of post-polio syndrome and not an altogether different entity is supported by two observations in this group of patients. One, new atrophy did not occur in any of the subjects as the only new health problem. And two, when it did occur, atrophy tended to be present when there were four or five other problems as well. When all the patients with post-polio syndrome had, by definition, while all the patients with post-polio syndrome had, by definition, two or more new health problems, the time from polio to onset of those problems varied, depending on the presence or absence of certain characteristics at the onset of polio. Using a modified life table technique, we identified four variables at onset of polio, which were strongly associated with developing new health problems many years later at a shorter interval. These variables were the same ones described in our two earlier questionnaire studies, namely hospitalization at onset, involvement of all four limbs, older at onset, in this case 7 years or older versus under seven, and use of a ventilator. The time to onset of new problems for a fifth variable, sex, was not significantly different. This slide and the next summarize these five variables with respect to developing the first new problem and list, as you can see in the middle column, the median time and standard error from polio to onset of the problem and the level of significance between the variable subgroups using a generalized Savage-Mantel-Cox test. Of these variables or risk factors, the need for hospitalization, ventilator use, and involvement of all four limbs in all likelihood reflect a common underlying variable, namely severity at onset. thus the two most important predictors of when someone in this group might develop new health problems related to polio were degree of severity and age at onset. This next slide shows the data for one of the variables, hospital status at onset, when it is plotted at two-year intervals to make cumulative incidence curves based on when individuals in each group developed their first new health problem. As you can see, the hospital group, indicated by the curve to your left, began developing new health problems earlier and at a faster rate than the non-hospital group, as shown by the slope of the lines. This next slide shows a similar cumulative incidence curve for onset of first new health problems by sex. Although neither sex was significantly associated with developing any of the new health problems earlier than the other, women had more problems and developed them slightly earlier post-polio than men. Turning now briefly to interventions, the next slide lists the most common recommendations and interventions for this group. All patients were given at least one intervention. The most common prescriptions for durable products were for new and or modified aids to improve posture, diminish pain, and enhance comfort. These included corsets, lumbar rolls, canes, crutches, etc., and were provided to 81% of the group. However, a simple listing of the number of things which were prescribed is deceptive. The fact is that post-polio patients often present with a series of complex, interrelated problems that are diagnostically difficult to sort out and represent a formidable challenge to manage clinically. Because many of the patients had become disenchanted or distrustful of the healthcare system from previous negative experiences, we found that it frequently took a number of clinic visits to establish enough trust before some of our recommendations were tried. However, among those patients who did make changes and reduce their activity level or go back to a wheelchair part-time, we noticed several encouraging outcomes. One, we were able to make them more comfortable and reduce their fatigue and pain. And two, over a period of a one-year follow-up, we found that the progression of weakness was less, and some people were beginning to stabilize their strength and occasionally improve it. Although the etiology of the post-polio syndrome remains obscure, we feel that these kinds of observations support the view that it is primarily an overuse phenomenon and therefore carries a good long-term prognosis.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over now and continue listening on side two.